Shrink Wrap Radio number 638, Seeing Differently, How to Change Your Perspective by Kristen Smedley.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Kristen Smedley, TEDx presenter and author of Thriving Blind, in which she shares the saga of raising two thriving blind sons. For more information about Kristen Smedley, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here is the interview. Kristen Smedley, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's really cool to be here.
Well, I'm lucky to have you here because I know you've been on the road a lot, doing a lot of traveling and presenting and so on. And you've got a book about your adventures with blindness, not your own, but you've got two blind sons, which we'll get into. And I want to start off by asking you, what was your life like before the birth of your first son, Michael, who turned out to be blind? What was your life like there?
Well, you know what? I guess by nature, I'm a planner. So I had planned a lot of things in my life, and everything at that moment, you know, before Michael was born, had gone according to plan. I even had the house with the, you know, back then it was the late 90s and they were calling them McMansions, you know, the bigger home and the perfect lawn. And I had the job in education, the neighborhood, everything. It was all the way I had planned.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you were lucky. That was a lucky place to be. But then you discovered that in fact, your first baby was blind. What was the impact on you finding that out?
Yeah, you know, according to plan, I even had the bouncing baby boy, you know, and then when I found out, and everything was wonderful. I mean, he was so magnificent. And then at 5 months old to hear your son is blind, I literally hit the floor. It was this tiny little exam room in the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And I hit the floor. I mean, it just, not only was it not what I planned, it was nothing I had experience with in my entire life. I mean, usually I'm an optimist and I can find a silver lining everywhere. There was no silver lining there for me. That was hard.
Yeah. Well, what was your expectation of what life would be like for Michael at that point?
You know, I think like most parents, and I know a lot of moms because I know I talk to so many moms, when you're, you know, we have that experience that as our belly is growing and the baby is growing, your dreams grow, right? I mean, and I'm a planner. I had envisioned, I was an athlete. His dad was an athlete. I envisioned him on the mound at the baseball game, all eyes on him, you know, him throwing the touchdown, him the valedictorian, him getting summa cum laude, all of that. And, wow. And as the pregnancy went and I was getting bigger and bigger, my dreams were like ginormous. And when I tell you in that moment of that one sentence, I mean, those are just a few words, your son is blind. It shut the whole picture dark.
Yeah. It must have been devastating because you had pinned so much of your own dreams and imagination, hopes and so on.
On
having a fully capable kid, boy, who was going to be athletic.
And look at like the baby clothes. Go down the aisle of the baby clothes at the store. Everything's got like little slugger with the baseball, you know, all the little football. I'm a huge Eagles fan here in Philadelphia, and all the little bibs and, you know, we all have these big dreams for these babies, right? And it just was, it was in at that moment. I've learned a lot since then, but at that moment it was gone. And even the doctor said, Kristen, your dreams for your son are gone.
That's what the doctor told you? Your dreams for your son are gone?
He said, I don't know what to tell you. Everything you had planned isn't going to happen. And he said, good luck.
Wow.
Yeah, they didn't know what to say back then. That was 19 years ago. I mean, unfortunately, people are still saying that, and there's no reason to say it like that anymore. But there really wasn't there wasn't the life that there is now. So back then, 19 years ago, it was heart-wrenching.
Well, what did you know about blindness 19 years ago?
You know, honestly, it sounds ridiculous now with the field that I'm in, but 19 years ago, what I knew was Stevie Wonder and Ray Charles, and I love my family, but we do not have musical talent like them. and I knew of the show Little House on the Prairie. I grew up with that show, and there was a character in that family on that show. Her name was Mary. They found out she woke up blind. They knew she was going to go blind, and then she woke up blind, and they shipped her off to a school for the blind. That is what I knew of blindness, and that's all that I knew. That really is it's a testament to the power of education and experience, because I had none in this realm. So I knew nothing, so I expected full devastation. Yeah. And that's what I had gotten for a while.
And so for a while, you were stuck in the feeling, I guess, really lucky, like you had been abandoned by the higher powers, et cetera, and that your life was going to be terrible, both for your son and for yourself. At some point, you got unstuck from all your fears and your depression and your anger. Do you remember that moment?
Yeah. So, you know, I was raised in faith, thank goodness. And like I said, I am an optimistic person. So I was kind of chugging along, but I was angry. I was angry in those first years that how could this possibly happen to a little kid, right? And I was actually pregnant with my second son. With this disease, there's a 25% chance with every pregnancy. But I came to the realization that coming from a large family, it would have been harder for me to raise a child being an only child than it would be to have two blind children. And quite frankly, being the forever optimist and living in full denial, I figured in my conversations with God that there was no way this would happen a second time. I was good to go. This was all I could take. It would one child, the second child surely would be fine.
Yeah.
And then it was very close to when I was going to give birth to my second child that I started to panic. And I had a day where there was a lot of days I couldn't even get out of bed in the morning. I was so devastated. There was a day I'd actually gotten out of bed and I didn't make it very far. And I was kind of having I was having a massive tantrum with, you know, it wasn't actually a prayer that people typically, in a way, people prayed. I was yelling, but I was yelling in my head because I could hear my son, Michael, who was 3 at the time, playing down the hallway. And he happened to come bouncing in my room. He, of course, had no idea the struggle I was in the middle of. Came bouncing into my room. And what he said to me was, "Isn't this the best day ever?"
Wow.
And I thought, are you kidding me? I had been sitting there for about an hour going through in my mind all the dreams that weren't going to happen, all the stuff he couldn't do, all those things that I wanted him to do and he couldn't. And he comes in and says, "Isn't this the best day ever?"
Wow.
And I said, "Why?" And he said, "The sun is up," when he was like bouncing and radiant all the time. He still is. He said, "The sun is up and I'm playing with all of my toys. And I am so happy." And then he bounced out of the room and went back to what he was doing. And I thought, what is the matter with me? I realized, thank God he bounced into my room at that moment. Because that's when I realized he didn't have the problem. I did. I was putting all of my hopes and dreams for him on him. And I never was stepping back to say, how's he handling this? How is he doing it? What are his hopes and dreams?
What a great moment of insight that was.
Oh, and I tell you, and he was so little for his age, and this cute little face with these little glasses, who couldn't even see me a foot in front of him. He didn't know I was standing there. It was the most powerful moment I think that I've ever experienced. And the way that he shifted my whole perception of this, in that moment, it changed everything. It did take a lot of work to remove my thoughts and dreams for him from the scenario.
Yeah.
And watch and let. But when I tell you, not only was it a blessing to then go out and get him all the things he needed, it was a blessing that I think, if I could verbalize it in a better way and I love your platform here to help get the word out, I think every parent should listen and have a moment where they really realize if you would take your own hopes and dreams off of your child and watch them. And because I didn't know what else to do but watch Michael and follow his lead.
Yeah, Yeah.
And it has taken us in extraordinary places.
I'm wondering what toys he was playing with. You know, you said he had been in his room happily playing with his toys. And because I don't have blind children, I don't have any notion of what that would have been like for him.
That is such an awesome question. You know what's funny? When I tell this story, nobody has asked me that, and so I so appreciate
Thank you. I have four kids and six grandkids, so I'm kind of oriented towards kids.
Yeah. Well, what a great educational moment, because honestly, it was probably a lot of the same toys that your kids and grandkids have. Lego, Lincoln Logs. There were, and when Michael was born, it was the year 2000. So a lot of the light up musical, mm-hmm. all that's when Mozart toys were big on the scene, and they all had this classical music, you know. So there was a lot of regular, air quote regular toys. The nice part for me was another perk to blindness, I guess I call it, is getting things like Lego and Lincoln Logs and stuff that people didn't necessarily introduce, or even Lincoln Logs. I mean, who really plays with those anymore? They're all those brain power type of imagination toys. And Michael could build the most amazing structures with Lincoln Logs, and he never saw those brochures that come with it.
Incredible.
You know? He just built it on his own.
So he's building structures that made sense and without any diagrams or anything like that.
Amazing, right? But it's one of those things, you give kids just that, some space with the tools and let's see what they come up with. And it's extraordinary.
Yeah. And, you know, you did a wonderful TEDx presentation.
Thanks.
You know, it was very inspiring. And one of the things that you observed was his blindness didn't seem to bother him at all. It was bothering you. It was a big deal for you. And for him, he was just being him.
He was just being him, and he was really, he literally was experiencing the world with everything that he was given. And there was just this one little thing that he didn't have, and it really didn't get in his way. And there's a lot of times when I see that blindness is such a gift, because, and he has said to me on many occasions throughout our life that sighted people are so distracted. And he'll say to me, stop focusing on what you're seeing. You know, listen, feel it, experience it. When we went surfing, he figured out the rhythm of the ocean. I had to keep waiting on the coach to tell me when to ride the wave. It took Michael a little while, and he fell a lot of times in the beginning, and then he figured it out, and he never fell again.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really extraordinary is the only word I can come up with it for it, because you know, but it really is an experience in using every gift and talent that you have and not focusing on what you don't have.
Yeah. Yeah. So then a certain amount of time goes by, I guess more than 3 years. And then you have a second son, Mitchell.
Yeah.
And it was actually a very rare form of blindness that Michael has. And then it turns out that Mitchell had the same rare blindness.
Yeah, there's only 300 kids in this country that are affected, and I have two of them.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was I'm not going to say that it didn't hurt when that diagnosis came. It was just as big a punch to the gut and the heart as it was to hear it the first time. But I will say that the second time around, I had what I didn't have the first time. And that was the perfect role model. I had Michael. I looked at him and saw that he was okay. You know, it was hard. It was a lot of extra energy and a lot of extra time, and I don't want to dishonor that. But he was perfectly happy, and as long as I got him all the tools he needed and taught him everything he needed to know, he was just fine. So I bounced back from that devastating diagnosis way, way quicker.
I'm wondering what it was like the moment that they sort of discovered each other. Of course, Michael had a head start. But the question comes from the fact that we had twin boys. And I remember the moment when they're both on one of those little baby holders sitting on the table, you know, that you would maybe feed them on, or probably be illegal today to have one of those. But so they were each in their little semi-reclining plastic thing, And at some point, they looked over and saw the other guy and started laughing.
You know? Aw, that's
and there
sweet.
Was just that moment of bonding. And I'm wondering if there was anything like that that you observed.
You know what? I have this beautiful picture of, it was actually Mitchell's baby announcement that I did. And it was maybe 2 days after he was home, where Michael just is so gently kissing him on the head. But from the minute Mitchell was born and Michael came to visit the hospital, he just was so in love with having a brother. So he was kind of always in Mitchell's face.
Yeah.
So Mitchell just had to discover him from the second he was born. It was great. It was really sweet. And because of their vision, they had to be up close and touching all the time to know that they were there. And that was, I think that's another beautiful, thing in the early bonds of brotherhood. Of course, now that they're both teenagers, you don't necessarily always want them up close next to each other.
Yeah, we went through something like that where with the twins, and one of them sort of needed to push the other one away to be on his own and have his own friends and be popular and all of that. And it was a painful adjustment for the other twin.
Yeah. Yeah. We just experienced that, this year, now that Michael went away to college and Mitch got to have the high school to himself and get out there and do his own thing and stop being in his brother's shadow. And it's something that it wasn't intentional from anybody. It was, you know, the community just has wrapped their arms around my family. And I think that a lot of people expect, because they both have the same disease, they are brothers, they look so similar, that they're going to be the same. And I was constantly saying, they are different right down to their retina. Their retina specialist says their retinas don't even look the same. They are completely opposite people.
Uh-huh.
So it was kind of a push and pull for a while. But now Mitchell's doing a lot of the stuff that Michael enjoys. And they have a lot of stuff to talk about. Still being completely different people with completely different interests, which is, it's been really neat. But we needed one to kind of move out of the bubble, you know, so the other one could have his own time to shine. And I think that happens with siblings all the time, no matter what the deal is.
Were there unexpected blessings for you in this tragedy?
You know what? So many that I called my blog, I Believe Miracles, because there's just so many. Even I talk about it in the TED Talk about, you know, I've learned to stop approaching things at what are they going to miss out? What do I have to be ahead of that they're going to miss? And just watch how they experience something. When we went snowmobiling, like we took them skiing in Colorado.
Amazing.
To this National Center for Disabled Sports. They are the best of the best to turn your kids over on a mountain to. And the boys had the time of their lives with guys that were really into skiing and being cool and all that. But then we went snowmobiling because I've always wanted to snowmobile. And even my daughter, who's sighted, looked at me and said, "Are you nuts? Like, really? We're throwing them on these snowmobiles. We're going to drive a bazillion miles an hour in the cold and everything." And I said, I just want to see what they get out of it, because I really would like to do this. Well, the stuff they talked about, you know, after, as we were at dinner and we're all talking, everyone that could see, we had this big conversation about, and the boys talked, I will not even exaggerate that it was at least an hour longer after we were all done with what we had to say that we saw, because they talked about when they knew that they were in like the tunnels of the trees and how they envisioned a scene in Star Wars would look like based on, and they were exactly right the way they described what we drove through. They were then telling us what we thought that the Star Wars scene was, and it was like that they had never seen.
Yeah.
Even getting up to the Continental Divide and where the air pressure changed and all of that. They knew stuff that we never even, it didn't even dawn on us that all that was happening around us.
Now, were they driving at all, or were they passengers on the snowmobile?
They were passengers. We did let Michael take a spin when we were up at the top and there was just wide open space.
Wow.
Because at that point, he was probably 14.
Yeah.
I want to say. Yeah. So he got to have he took a turn at it for a little bit. Mitchell, there was no way in heck that he was too creepy back then. He would have sent us right off the mountain.
Yeah. Pretty chancy. Yeah. So what did you learn about yourself through all of this?
You know, it used to drive me crazy when people would say, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And if one more person said that to me in the very beginning, I thought,
yeah.
And if anyone were to ship a pillow to me with that on it, forget about it. I did not want to hear that.
Yeah.
I did learn, though, to, as a mom, I think it has made me the strongest mom that I never dreamed that I would be, and the best mom. I dreamt my whole life. My biggest plan was to be a mom. That was my number one thing I wanted. It's the only thing that worked out in my life that I became a mom. But it has made me a mom that I never dreamed of, because I had to learn to let it go early. Like, let them, you know, let go, let God, let them be out. It's their journey. I'm here to support. I'm here to bring them the things that they need. But it's their journey, not mine.
Yeah.
And being able to back up and know nothing of what to expect other than an extraordinary journey and take it all in. And when they say, you know, don't sweat the small stuff, for me, it's celebrate the small stuff. I mean, I think a lot of my friends with kids that don't have any challenges are missing a lot of the little pieces of the big picture. I mean, for me, my son's being able to be on a baseball team. I wasn't worried about if they were going to be the star like everybody else is. I just wanted them to enjoy it, be able to contribute and experience it. It's a lot different than putting on them all of your hopes and dreams.
Yeah. How can they be on a baseball team?
I know. That's everybody's questions. It's wild. You know, they started out in blind sports where they went to a team in the city and learned all the different sports and found the ones that they were really interested in. Mm-hmm. But then Michael said, when he was 9 years old, I love going to that, mom. I love playing. It's called beep baseball, where things beep and the bases buzz and all that. And he was very good at it. So much so that the team was like nine and the teenagers didn't want, when they heard Michael was coming up to the plate, they were mad because they knew that he was going to beat them. But anyway, he wanted to play on the regular neighborhood team. And we walked in and the commissioner of the league said, okay, after a few minutes, and found a team for him to be on, and with a coach that was unbelievable. And the, you know what the coach did? And this is a big credit to him. He came over to our house and said, I want to meet Michael. I want to talk to you guys. I want to see how to make this work, that he's not just the kid on the team, that he can contribute. And I want to figure it out. And I want you guys to help me.
Wow.
And we figured it out. I mean, Michael had to, he had to let go of the fact that he was nine and had to hit off a tee. That was hard.
Uh-huh. I mean,
think about nine-year-old boys that get to now swing in coach pitch or in kid pitch. And he was embarrassed by that at first. And I said, you know, you can stand up there and swing if that's what you want to do, but I'm not having them change the rules for you. You get three swings. And what are the chances that you're going to connect? Slim to none. We did the percentages and statistics because he's a numbers guy. I said, but you get three swings on a tee, and what are the chances you're going to connect? How are you going to help the team? Swinging and missing or connecting? So he finally gave in and he hit off a tee. And when I tell you, he led his team in RBIs.
Wow.
That year.
Yeah.
Now, his thing was because my boys are brilliant and I'm not, but they go into this speech about velocity and when a ball is moving versus a ball that's standing still. And his thing was he would never hit it over the fence. And he was upset by that. And I thought, I said, well, you might never hit it over the fence, but how else can you help the team? You can get at least somebody's on third, you can hit them in. You know, you get on base, you're a base runner. I mean, you're not going to hit it over the fence. Does everybody hit it over the fence? No. I mean, you got to give up on some of it, right? And then he played in the outfield. They played in the outfield with another guy. So the other guy would field it and hand it to my son. And if it was Michael out there playing, the whole team and the crowd learned to not say a word. Because if the play was, say the play was at third base, the third baseman would call Michael's name and he would throw it on a dime to where he heard his name being called.
Wow.
It was cool.
Yeah. That's so moving just to hear about. And so a sighted sister gets born, and how does that, you know, what's the impact on family dynamics and so on there?
You know, it's interesting because Carissa was born into inclusion. She was born into things being accessible. I mean, I say in the TED Talk, she walked the bridges that we spent all these years building. So in her little mind, she didn't see disability. She didn't see, you know, her experience was that her experience was so normal. In her little mind, it was so normal that she had a friend over when she was about 2.5, 3 years old. And the friend saw one of the boys' Braille machines on the kitchen table. And the friend said, "What is that?" And Carissa was like, and this little girl came from a very big family. And she said, "You have brothers. You don't know what that is? It's a Braille machine." She's like, "Don't your brothers know Braille?" And the girl was like, didn't even know what that word was, right? And Carissa said to me, "Mom, call her mom. She's going to get those boys Braille. How are they going to read?" So in her little three-year-old mind, she assumed, I mean, all her brothers were blind. So, of course, all brothers are blind.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? Yeah. Kids make assumptions, I guess. Based on observation.
Yeah, speaking of the Braille machine, talk to us about assistive technologies and which ones have been helpful and, you know, what the status of that is.
Well, I'll say this first. The fact that my boys were born in the year 2000 and the year 2003 is one of the biggest reasons that I say I can find a blessing and a silver lining anywhere. Because, I mean, the folks that were growing up blind 50 years ago, what a different story. Even 10 years before my boys, what a different story. Because we have an electronic Braille machine now where you can hook it up to a regular printer. They're typing in Braille and they're reading in Braille, but it prints out regular print for a teacher in a classroom or mailing a letter. You know, all the things for a sighted person on the other side of that paper can read it.
Yeah.
That was huge for us to not have to have anybody translating the Braille anymore.
Yeah.
They can also take any book for the most part. Most books you can get in a downloadable Braille and on a jump drive, put it into that machine and they can read. That's how they read all their textbooks. They laugh at the beginning of the year when everybody's lugging all their textbooks and my boys just have a jump drive. That's what all their textbooks are on. That's a big, you know, perk. And honestly, I was not a happy person about Apple when Apple came on the scene and you had to buy this and buy that. Then they changed the phone and changed the charger and I was furious. But iPhones, that changed the entire game socially for my boys. Because the iPhone, I'll show it on for the video for your audience. You know, on this iPhone, all those apps, it has a built-in talking feature. So the boys hit the home button 3 times and the whole phone talks. I didn't have to buy any software for it. I didn't have to upgrade anything. And all of their texts, it announces it to them. They can slow it down, speed it up so nobody even knows what the gibberish is. They can get their emails. They go on the internet. That little $50 a month is the best $50 a month I spend for them.
Yeah, I've always been impressed by Apple in that regard, that they put so much energy into assistive technology, and it's incredible. And even for somebody who's just older, like I am, hey, I want the screen to show larger writing, you know, than other people need to be able to use it. And there are ways that, you know, people who are just age is affecting them or other kinds of disabilities that, you know, are supported. Because Apple has that commitment.
I'm impressed and grateful that they've developed this kind of technology because my guys, honestly, it when they were able to do that texting back in fifth, sixth grade, when everybody was getting into that, they were right there. Before that, they were on the sidelines of a lot of social stuff. But these kinds of things, they're able to sit, you know, people joke that they can't stand kids are sitting next to each other texting and doing the emojis. And I'm like, but that my guys know everything going on in a group text because everybody's reading it. You know, they miss the facial features and all with kids. But yeah, they're right in there socially. It's great.
Yeah, I was going to say how has their social life been for them coming up through school? You know, kids can be very ugly sometimes in terms of teasing and excluding people that are different. How's that gone for them?
You know what? I think, and I would bet that a lot of parents would agree with this. It's a different generation now that they have grown up in inclusion. So like our school district has been big on inclusion from the time the kids get into kindergarten. You know, there's a lot of different abilities and whatnot in a classroom. So they had that going for them.
Yeah.
And honestly, they have been involved in so many things in this community that, I mean, to be 9 years old and blind and on a baseball team and contribute in the way that Michael did, kids were kind of like, there was no more of a, whoa, you know, this kid is different, or this kid, you know, it really set him up for some great success.
Yeah.
And, kids were very kind. We've had issues with adults that kids in middle school had to step in and deal with some adults that were not kind.
Wow.
But there was a kid one time that was extremely unkind to Michael, but, by that point, so many kids knew and loved Michael that they all came to his side and basically said to the kid, we're not standing for this. That's why all those programs out there that right now that say, you got to step in for kids, step in and say something.
Yeah.
It's so powerful because it really shuts all that stuff down.
Wow.
All of that said, I will say I was just talking with some moms that are in the middle of middle school right now. And there was a mom that warned me and a 20-something-year-old guy that warned me years ago, middle school is tough. It's tough on every person on this planet. And when
yeah.
you've got something that, you know, like blindness, that's tough to get out there and socialize, it was a little more isolating than I hadn't thought it would be. And it just is what it is. It's not that the kids did anything intentional. Just kids in middle school are so stuck in themselves and worrying about themselves at that age that they didn't have anything in them to remember to include Michael. Now, Michael's good because he works around things. He started a band, you know, so he had his own little core group. But he just had to, I've said to moms, you gotta hang in there. I went to the movies with my guys when they didn't have anybody to go to the movies with, if there was a movie they wanted to see. I went to all the different events and helped them through. And then by high school, the kids came back around when they're not as weird like they are in middle school, you know.
Yeah.
But you can't sit there and be angry about it. I mean, every kid along the way has stuff they've got to deal with. And I have found the biggest blessing is that my guys had to figure this stuff out early on. Michael had some time on his own in middle school when kids weren't knocking on the door to play anymore. But you know what? That's when he found his passion for music. And when he didn't have time with other people, he would spend time playing on the piano. And now he's an extremely popular and successful rock band guy that plays piano and sings. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's great. You know, I've mentioned the TEDx presentation that you did, which was really wonderful. And I'm wondering, how did you become such a great speaker? You look so comfortable and you're so lively. And where does that come from?
You know what's funny? I said to my daughter, who's very, very shy, I told her one time she had to speak in school in fifth grade. And she just, I mean, you ask her to stand up in front of people, at that point, she would turn green. And I said to her, guess who was there? Was this girl in my class in fifth grade that even when she raised her hand and got called on, she would turn green. I said, that was me. I was that kid. I was shy. I was nervous. But I think because I trained to be a teacher, my whole life I wanted to be a teacher. So I just kind of called upon the skills that I learned to stand up in front of a classroom. And that's where I was really comfortable when I had something that I needed the kids to learn. And I would become this Broadway show up there to get them engaged and yeah. be interested, you know, and let's be honest. I mean, talking about blindness and rare disease, I mean, it's not an uplifting conversation that people walk into. And to hold people's attention, you kind of gotta, you know, be a little dynamic.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's my boys and so many others that are relying on people like me to blaze a trail here and change perceptions to change outcomes, sooner than later. So yeah. And I love talking about my kids and, all the stuff that they've done. So,
well, I think you've become kind of a motivational speaker, haven't you? It's sort of kind of expanded to that, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know what's funny? I just did a post on Instagram today about the fact that this past weekend I gave the biggest, in terms of biggest audience, speech of my life, and I finally figured out, I did a lot of research and a lot of soul searching in the past year and a half of how to get my message out there the right way. You know, what do I want people to learn from me? What is my actual calling? And it is actually has transcended blindness. It's not really about raising blind kids. It's about helping people understand that we're all going to hit a challenge and a roadblock. And how do you look at it and move on? That's what I've really learned, right? Yeah. So I have been researching what's the best way to deliver that message. And especially for my personality and my easily distracted, and I've really gotten to know myself, and delivered this speech to a group of folks out in Nashville on Saturday. And it was an hour long. And I typically an hour long, you know, having to stay on script and remember my slides sends me over the edge. It was the best I had ever done. In fact, one of my podcast partners was there taking pictures for me and helping me sell books. And she was in awe that it was the greatest delivery I ever had. And then there were people sitting on the floor because there were no more seats.
Wow. Yeah.
And I got a standing ovation at the end from over 1,000 people, but everybody came to me and it was the most beautiful moment of my life, which is going to sound ridiculous, but I'll explain. They no longer said to me, "You're a great mom." I've been hearing that for 19 years. "You're a great mom," which is, I love it, right? It's my number one job. What they said to me was, "You just changed my life."
Uh-huh. Wow.
So I was finally able to make that switch from what is it that I know about raising a blind child to thrive that can transcend anything that hits you in the gut and get people out of being stuck. And I finally figured it out all these years later.
Well, good for you. So you've got a book, actually, that you've just published, your first book. Mm-hmm. And the title is Thriving Blind, Stories of Success Without Sight. So that's wonderful. I guess you've collected stories from other people.
Yeah, you know what? It was actually people I've met along this journey that, and this thing started out as a little, I literally wanted to be a little almost pamphlet to give to doctors that diagnose, that give families a diagnosis of blindness, because never again did I want to hear that a mom had to sit there and hear, "I don't know what to tell you. Good luck."
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, sadly enough, it's still happening. I'm still getting messages from moms that they did their own search on Google and found me because a doctor said, "I don't know what to tell you." And in this day and age, that's crazy with the internet and the resources that I know that are out there. So I figured, well, I'll put it in a little pamphlet to give to all the doctors and all the doctor's offices so that people can see, oh, there's a blind mountain climber, a blind teacher, and okay, there's some hope for my child. But then I thought, well, hope can only carry us so far, right? So let's put a little resources in there.
Yeah.
Then it was around, I always kind of had this in my mind that there should have been a pamphlet handed to me. And then Michael was trying to get a book back in elementary school that was so goofy. And he couldn't get it in Braille. And the whole class got theirs in print through one of those Scholastic book orders. And we couldn't get it in Braille. And I was furious. So then all these years later, when I decided, let's make this thing into a book for families of blind kids. And then I'm like, I'm going to self-publish it because I want to know, before I start blaming the publishing industry for slacking off for blind readers, what are the problems? Because why would you just go out there yelling at people when you don't really know their road? What are the issues along the way? Yeah. So I self-published it to find out where the issues are so I can say, it is your fault, publishers. You're not, it isn't their fault, actually. It's a problem in, I don't know. It's a problem in the blind community, in the accessibility community. It's multiple, there's multiple stakeholders involved at the fact that we cannot get a hard copy Braille version of books in an easy, inexpensive way. It's making me crazy, but that's what I'm working on now.
Yeah. And you've become an advocate, right? You're on boards and so on. Tell us about that part of your life.
Yeah, I always say that I'm the accidental advocate. I did not intend for any of this. But so when we found out Michael's specific genetic cause of the blindness in 2009, it took us 9 years to get a definitive diagnosis. There was some headway being made in vision restoration in gene therapy.
Wow.
And at that time in 2009, I still was not fully, I mean, I wanted it fixed. I was, you know, we were, he was thriving and I was getting him everything, but I wanted it fixed. I thought it would be a better day if he could see. And an interesting journey it's been to, I started the patient organization for his their blindness. It was supposed to be just research for a cure. And then as I was watching Michael and Mitchell, and I thought, they might not be interested in a cure someday. Who am I? Who am I to put fix and cure on them when they might not be interested in that? They were happy as could be doing the things they were doing.
Yeah.
So we split the focus of the foundation to raise awareness and education and resources for families living with blindness. And the other side of it is research for a potential treatment.
Yeah.
And my job, which I am very open about, is to be the bridge between diagnosis and potential treatment. And my goal is that my boys and everyone diagnosed with this are so confident in their skills of blindness and success without sight and have a full life that it's going to be very hard for them to choose whether they want their vision restored or not.
Yeah, I was amazed to learn that in the deaf community, there are people who are kind of militantly deaf. And, you know, they've got a life that they love and they don't want to try to have to enter into the world of hearing.
Yeah.
But that was shocking to learn.
Yeah, me too. That's when I started, you know, and because I was meeting these blind adults that were so comfortable, and some of them are interested in a cure and some are not. And then here I am with two boys that are very different, and at different times in their lives, they'll be probably interested in vision and not. So that's my role now, is to at least get my job, I feel, as a mom, is to get options on the table. And honestly, my oldest, Michael, had said, when he was getting ready for college, I'm not interested. Because somebody said, are you so excited that all the stuff that's going on in research, we're so close to you being able to see? He said, actually, I'm not interested. That would hold me back right now. I'm going to go to college and do college the way I've done my whole life.
Yeah.
And he said, when I come back, I'll think about it. And she was devastated. And I said, as a mom, I'm going to get emotional. That's my biggest success.
Yeah.
I've done my job. He's so confident and comfortable.
Right.
It's a hard choice for him.
Yeah.
Wow. So again, we're not putting our dreams on him. We're going to let him, I'm going to follow his lead.
Yeah.
And maybe that opinion will change when he gets out of the, you know, the bubble of college and the bubble of everything, you know, we shall see. But
yeah,
I will totally follow his lead.
Uh-huh. Good. And you mentioned podcast in passing there. And you have a podcast? Another competitor.
I don't know. Our podcast is Four Chicks Chatting, and it's literally four friends, girlfriends of mine, colleagues of mine, that we were in a mastermind last year. We got into this mastermind to build our own businesses, me being the only nonprofit. And to know the mastermind model, you know, we would all come together and go over our goals and help each other achieve goals and you know, weed out the stuff we shouldn't be working on, sounding boards and all that.
Uh-huh.
And then we started, we live in the same county and it was too hard to travel the 20 minutes here and there. So we would do it online on Skype. And then, all of a sudden I was winning awards. The other girls were winning awards. Businesses were going insane. We were having so much success that everyone that knew us was saying, how can we get in your mastermind?
Huh.
And, you know, then we went through a bunch of different business models of how to bring people in. And then one of the girls finally said, why don't we just do a podcast? And then we can just, you know, teach everybody what we've learned. And that's how Four Chicks Chatting came about. It's evolving now. Instead of just the four of us chatting about growing our businesses, now we have guests on that have written books that empower women and stuff like that. But so now I'm like, I think we might be five chicks because we always have a guest, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's definitely it's a women. We call it the Womenish podcast for business and personal development. That's
uh-huh.
our thing.
Well, that's the right category to be in terms of podcasting. Of what I've learned by not being in that, the podcasts that really make money are the ones that teach other people how to make money.
Yeah.
People will pay for that.
We're not making anything yet, except we're having a really good time.
Yeah.
We shall see.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I think that those of us who do not have a disability often feel awkward around somebody who does, and we don't know what to say, how to act. Do you have any advice around that?
You know, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that's one of the biggest reasons that I started talking about blindness, because I didn't want to talk about it in the beginning. I hated going to Disney World when everybody would stare. You know, my town is so used to seeing the canes, but then you go to Disney World and you've got millions of people standing there staring at you. It drove me crazy. And I realized it's because people are uneducated. You're exactly right. They don't know what to say. So it gets very awkward. Uh-huh. So I started going to the PTO and back to school night, the teacher would talk and then I would talk and say, look, you know, my kid's in your class. It's okay. You can talk to them. But my boys would probably agree that just asking, hey, you know, can you tell me about that? Or how do you need – the thing is, especially in the blind community, I think – I forget what the hashtag is that's going around right now. It's something like ask me, don't grab me, something like that. Like a lot of people think that when a blind person's about to cross the street, they have to grab their arm and say, here, let me help you.
Yeah, that can be very scary too and intrusive if you don't know – somebody's reaching out for you.
Well, plus the fact that a blind person is trained. I mean, my boys are still training. Michael's ninth. Well, he doesn't train anymore. He was trained all these years, 18 years. There are methods that they do to listen to the traffic, to focus on where they're standing on that street corner. There's a lot of things that they do that our eyes do. They do it with all their other senses. So when someone comes up and yanks them, it gets them all turned around. I mean, it's not good. But a simple, do you need help crossing the street? Simple question, makes a world of difference. And it's funny because Michael would probably say, I got this. Mitch would be like, hey, yeah, you want to help me out with something? I'm in. It's totally a personality thing with just like it is with sighted people. Everybody's different whether they want help or not. Yeah. But a simple question is fine.
Right. Well, as we wind things down, I guess, I wonder if there's anything more that you want to say that you were hoping to say, planning to say, being a planner.
You know, my biggest thing is, look, I'm 47 and a half years old, and who would have thought that I'd be an author now? And 19 years ago, who would have thought that I'd be a mom raising blind kids? I mean, you never know. Who would have thought I'd be a single mom now trying to financially support my family, you know, by myself? So you never know what's going to come down the pike. And you can sit on the couch like I did and cry for 3 years and pray it away. And I can tell you from experience that does not work. I tried it. Praying it away does not work. So I say find the people that are where you want to be or are on the road to where you want to be. They're on the other side and ask them for help. Uh-huh. Build your team of those folks. And whether you like it or not, you got to get the tools you need. I did not like to hear about Braille and the white cane when my kids were little. I had to just get over it. Right now, as a business owner, I hate spreadsheets, but I just did my taxes all by myself for the first time ever. I hate spreadsheets. I hate the numbers. But I did the taxes. I did that and I'm keeping up on things. You know, you've got to do it. And when you face those fears and you build a team to help you with it and get the tools you need, it's just so much easier. And you end up saving yourself a lot of time and frustration, but definitely, find folks to be on your team. And I will say that my Michael, he ended up, they expected him in kindergarten to achieve only at 70% of the sighted kids in our public school. And I fought tooth and nail to keep him on a level playing field and have the expectation be the same as everybody else. And by high school graduation, he was the commencement speaker and had out-achieved all 600 kids for the most part. But my point in telling that story is, as commencement speaker, he said the same message: build your team, ask for help when you need it. But he added one more thing that I'll leave everybody with. He said, look up and look around, because life is not a one-way street. Whose team can you be on? Who can you reach out to? And who can you build up as well?
Well, that's a great message for us to close on. So, Kristen Smedley, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. It was such an honor and privilege to have a conversation with you like this. I appreciate it.
What an inspiration Kristen Smedley is. It's not just that she was able to raise two blind sons who are so well adapted that they are not sure they would choose to be able to see if the technology ever makes that possible, but also that she's learned so much about herself in the process, and that as her youngsters have become more independent, she's gone on to develop a professional life as an author and advocate for the blind, and as an inspirational speaker beyond the topic of blindness. Her story is one of incredible resilience. Of course, she did what she had to do. That's what being a parent demands of us. But the anger, sense of betrayal by God, and depression of such a major challenge is totally understandable. She had expansive visions of her future, and they appeared to be dashed. And though it comes across as trite, it's these kinds of experiences that offer the potential for growth. It's easier to say than to do, and not everyone rises to the challenge. This is a lesson I've learned in my own life as well. Nothing as large as what Kristen had to deal with, thankfully, but who knows what lies down the road. When future challenges do show up, I hope I'll remember Kristen's story and also the lessons of my own past. I'm also moved by the resilience of her two sons who've risen to the challenges they've been presented with, and I'm also struck by the natural resilience of these boys to accept the hand that they've been dealt and to thrive despite it. I'm glad to hear Kristen's experience that at least some schools are teaching acceptance of differences, and that her sons have enjoyed the benefits of that. That's certainly what the world needs more of. It certainly suggests the direction we need to be moving in as a society. Blind kids skiing, playing baseball, sounds impossible, miraculous even, but so much is possible if we can ask for assistance and give it as well. And the mastermind development training that Kristen has been taking clearly is elevating her game, which really underscores the real message of this session, which is there are no limits to what we can achieve with love, compassion, courage, and teamwork.
My name's Trish, and I'm a psychologist and psychotherapist. I've donated to Shrink Wrap Radio because I think it's a fantastic resource. I live in a rural area several hours' drive from a state capital, and I don't get to attend many seminars. Shrink Wrap Radio is a tangible contributor to my ongoing professional development. It helps me keep up to date, and I love hearing the leaders in the trauma and interpersonal neurobiology fields talk about their work. It gives me a different perspective on their ideas and helps me get my head around some of the complexities. I also really appreciate the Jungian and transpersonal things that Dr. Dave covers. Thank you very much, Dr. Dave. I appreciate what you do for all of us.
Thank you, Trish. Well, I appreciate what you do for me. If you're not already doing so, won't you please join Trish by becoming a regular donor? Just go to shrinkwrapradio.com and choose the Support Us item in the top menu and select the PayPal level that you can afford. And with that, I think I'll wrap it up for today. Thanks to today's guest, TEDx presenter and author, Kristen Smedley, for a very inspiring interview. My next guest will be licensed professional counselor, Melissa Glasser, who is also the author of the 2018 book, Healing a Community, Lessons for Recovery After a Large-Scale Trauma. We'll be discussing what she learned during her work as the coordinator of the Newtown Recovery and Resilience Team after the shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.